Hugo Chavez's legacy is revered by his friends and scorned by his enemies, and those reactions were mirrored in media coverage. Death of a Demagogue was Time's headline. We'll discuss coverage with The New Yorker's John Lee Anderson, who first met Chavez in 1999, and McClatchy's Kevin Hall, who covered Chavez for a decade. Columbia Journalism Review's Trudy Lieberman will be here to talk about coverage of Social Security and Medicare. We'll discuss a New York Times opinion piece called The War on Entitlements. Where are the facts? Join us after the news.
BBC News with Fiona MacDonald. The state funeral of the Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is underway in the capital, Caracas. The National Youth Orchestra, directed by the world-renowned Venezuelan conductor Gustavo Dudamel, opened the ceremony at the Military Academy with the national anthem. Leaders from the region and beyond took turns forming a guard of honour around the coffin. Shouts of "The battle continues" rang out between renditions of popular music from the Venezuelan plains, the region where Mr. Chavez was born. Will Grant is in Caracas.
The mourning for President Chavez has been gradually building to a crescendo, and today at his funeral it will likely hit fever pitch. There are thousands of people in the queue to view Mr. Chavez's body lying in state, and many of them are simply trying to protect themselves from the punishing sun. Meanwhile, in the chapel at the front of the queue, the more formal funeral proceedings have been taking place. Mr. Chavez's key allies are here, and it's a list that includes Raul Castro of Cuba, the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and the president of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko. Washington have also sent a delegation, perhaps hoping to normalize relations with Caracas a little in the wake of Mr. Chavez's death.
One of Osama bin Laden's closest aides has pleaded not guilty to charges of plotting to kill Americans. Suleiman Abu Ghaith, a son-in-law of the late al-Qaeda leader, entered the plea in a New York court. Here's our North America correspondent, Johnny Diamond.
Just a few blocks from the site of the World Trade Center in a United States District Court, Suleiman Abu Ghaith was asked if he understood his rights and if he had money to hire an attorney. Through a court-provided lawyer, he entered his plea, not guilty to the charge of conspiracy to kill nationals of the United States. He had travelled to Afghanistan in 2000. Once there, he joined up with al-Qaeda. On the night of 9/11, US authorities allege, he was called upon by Osama bin Laden for assistance. The next day, he appeared next to the al-Qaeda leader in a video.
The jobs market in the United States improved more than expected in February, with the unemployment rate falling to 7.7%. Andrew Walker reports.
The new figures show a marked increase in job creation. Private employers took on almost a quarter of a million new workers in February. If sustained in coming months, this kind of performance would suggest the US economy may be gathering some momentum after a recovery from the financial crisis that has not been strong. The unemployment rate has moved lower, although it would need to come down a lot further, by another 1.2 percentage points, before the Federal Reserve would consider ending its policy of interest rates close to zero.
World News from the BBC. A court in Argentina has found the former president, Carlos Menem, guilty of illegally selling arms to Croatia and Ecuador in the 1990s. The appeals court's verdict overturned a ruling in 2011 by a lower court. Carlos Menem was accused of selling 6,500 tons of arms, which were officially destined for Panama and Venezuela. Ecuador and Croatia were involved in regional conflicts at the time and were under an arms embargo. 4 days after the general election in Kenya, the presidential race is still extremely tight. With nearly 90% of constituencies declared, Uhuru Kenyatta remains in the lead, but is just short of the more than 50% needed to avoid a runoff with his closest challenger, Raila Odinga. Roman Catholic cardinals gathered at the Vatican have voted to begin their conclave to elect a new pope on Tuesday. The previous pope, Benedict XVI, stepped down last month, the first pontiff to do so in 600 years. James Robbins reports from Rome.
The cardinals have spent the past week worshipping, praying, but above all, in daily meetings to discuss the vital qualities their choice of pope must possess. This will be a conclave like no other, prompted by a papal resignation at a time of crisis for the Catholic Church. And this time there are signals many cardinals hope to break decisively with the past, particularly the immediate, painful past. That could, just could, mean they choose a non-European pope, defying more than 1,000 years of tradition.
Several opposition activists have been detained in Moscow during a protest on International Women's Day in support of two imprisoned female members of the punk band Pussy Riot. The demonstrators gathered outside the headquarters of Russia's prison service. They held placards calling for the release of the two women imprisoned last year. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Millions of Venezuelans are in Caracas mourning the loss of President Hugo Chavez. He died on Tuesday of a massive heart attack. He was 58. His legacy is revered by his friends and scorned by his enemies. And those reactions were mirrored in media coverage. Death of a demagogue was Time's headline. CNN host Anderson Cooper declared it was, quote, the death of a world leader who made America see red, as in Fidel Castro red, Venezuela's social president Hugo Chavez. ABC World News viewers were told that, quote, many Americans viewed him as a dictator. The BBC reports that Chavez has left the Venezuelan economy in a muddle, so every Venezuelan now has a more equal slice of the cake. The trouble is that cake has not been getting much bigger. And then Haaretz says that Chavez's foreign policy was one big provocation. Reporter Kevin Hall writes that Hugo Chavez was not the caricature of a strong-armed buffoon that his critics painted. His knowledge of Latin American culture and history was deep and appreciated even by his detractors across the Americas and the hemisphere. Kevin Hall watched Hugo Chavez in action up close for almost a decade as a foreign correspondent for McClatchy, where he is now the national economics reporter based in Washington. Hi, Kevin. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And we're also joined by The New Yorker's John Lee Anderson. He first saw Hugo Chavez in 1991, and in his latest piece, he writes, quote, what he has left is a country that in some ways will never be the same, and which in other ways is the same Venezuela as ever, one of the world's most oil-rich but socially unequal countries, with a large number of its citizens living in some of Latin America's most violent slums. John Lee Anderson has covered a number of conflicts, including Iraq and Afghanistan, and most recently the civil wars in Libya and Syria. He traveled to Venezuela regularly during Chavez's presidency and interviewed him several times. He is the author of several books, including a biography of Che Guevara. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Great to have you.
Thank you.
And later in the show, we'll be talking about coverage of Social Security and Medicare. These two are getting national headlines because President Obama says they are on the table. And we're going to be talking about a New York Times opinion piece by Thomas Edsall. And he writes, the debate over reform of Social Security and Medicare is taking place in a vacuum without adequate consideration of fundamental facts. So where are the facts? Trudy Lieberman covers this extensively. She's a longtime contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review, where she covers healthcare, Social Security, and Medicare. Hi, Trudy. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thank you. Good to be back.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Trudy, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, besides Tom Edsall's piece, I want to come back to Stephen Brill's piece that was published last week, but it's still getting a lot of traction, which I'm very happy to see.
And just quickly, Trudy, we have not covered that yet. It's on our list. So to give listeners a little background, Stephen Brill wrote a piece about health care for Time magazine. It's the longest piece the magazine has ever run.
Right. And I did my own critique of Brill's piece, which I liked very, very much, in Columbia Journalism Review this week on CJR.org. And I think it's worth talking about, and I'll do when my turn comes, because he talks a lot about Medicare, and he tries to reframe the Medicare discussion. And for that, I think he's kind of broken through the fences that have for too long prescribed what the media says or is acceptable coverage of Medicare.
All right, so kudos to Stephen Brill. And again, we will get him on the show hopefully in the next couple weeks because this piece was so massive. I think it took up the entire magazine, actually.
Almost.
Yeah, all right, so thank you. We'll put a link to that on the website right after the show. And what about you, John? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, to be honest, I've been completely swamped by the impact of Chavez's death. There's been a number of pieces, and so I will just, I'm sorry to be boring, but I'll stick with that. It was a very good obituary in The Guardian by Rory Carroll, who also coincidentally has a book out, which is quite well-timed, called Comandante, about the life and legacy of Hugo Chavez. That's the British Guardian. And then a Venezuelan colleague who blogged for The New Yorker has done a very good piece on sort of what's next in The New Yorker. Those are the two pieces out of the... I've mostly spent the week talking, and so...
Well, that's fine.
That's what's been on my horizon.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, that's not boring at all. In fact, we wanted to talk with you about Rory Carroll's article, and so we'll do that in just a couple minutes. But we'll see if Kevin Hall has a piece that doesn't have anything to do with Chavez, or if it does, that's fine. What did you see this week, Kevin?
Sadly, I'm going right down that Chavez lane.
Okay.
I think there's a very nice editorial op-ed piece in the New York Times by Luis Inácio da Silva, Lula, the Brazilian president. And I think he does a real nice job of capturing, acknowledging Chavez's many flaws, but also noting why so many people are talking about Chavez and why his death isn't just the death of Caudillo, a strongman in the region, but the kind of guy that garnered global attention. I think the piece in the New York Times by Lula does a nice job of kind of spelling out who Chavez was in terms of leadership.
Well, so let's, since you both brought up pieces about Chavez, let's dive in and talk about this, because the news of his death sparked intense, immediate reactions by people who supported him and then people who opposed him. And, I mean, it's just all over the board. It's interesting to look at the way the U.S. media has covered this. But overall, Kevin, why don't we start off with you, because you have covered Chavez. You covered him for almost a decade. What did you think about this intense, immediate response?
Yeah, I think it speaks to his importance. And I think a lot of the one thing that struck me in the reporting, and I guess I have a bias against TV reporting, and I think that's been more bombastic and, the death of a rebel leader or whatever. But I think people who seriously analyze Chavez have to look at kind of two Chavezes. There was the Chavez, the State Department always used to say, look what he does, not what he says. And that changed after the coup. John can correct my dates here. I believe it was in 2002, which the only country in the hemisphere that recognized the coup plotters and Carmona as the president was the United States. It was a shameful moment in our contemporary Latin American history, of which, sadly, there have been many. But I think that changed Chavez's view about us and made him much more aggressive in terms of trying to strike out at our interests. And I think that was something that's been missed in a lot of the reporting.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, because there's a great documentary that opens today called Harvest of Empire that looks at U.S. foreign policy in Latin America. We did a show about it earlier this week. And what are your thoughts on this, John? Have you been seeing reporting that does bring in the history between Venezuela and the United States?
Well, I think, I've commented on it myself, and I I think in the kind of requiem, the reflections that, many people have weighed in to offer this week, I think, and especially, I guess, on the left, there's been a pointing out that, Chavez's antagonism, his adoption of, in some cases, a fairly unsavory cast of international allies, really has its origins in that kind of before and after moment of 2002 April, I think it was, when he was briefly seized, forced rather humiliating to resign, and then returned to office by a cabal of military officers connected with the private sector, the conservative private sector, and the fact that the White House then under George W. Bush had apparently known about the coup but not told him. He was already predisposed against it. He was trying to, to create a kind of a sovereign left of center revolutionary state in Latin America. And after that, and coinciding with, Bush's extraordinary unpopularity on the world scene, he really soured on the Americans and became much more confrontational. So part of the assessment of Chavez has to look at that, You know, he was a very reactive man, and he was a very candid man. Whenever, you know, these weren't things that one simply speculated about. He actually talked about them. For instance, his adoption of socialism. I asked him about it, and he, you know, with real candor, basically, you know, went on a soliloquy in which he told me, I'm a self-taught man. You know, I'm not a learned man, and so I came to things late. It's true. Everybody, you know, abandoned it 20 years ago, but I decided to abandon it, and part of it is my reverence for Fidel, who, as you know, is like a father to me, and part of it was my reading of, you know, Victor Hugo's Les Misérables, which may sound funny to people, but this was Hugo Chavez. You know, what you saw was what you got. He spoke his heart, and this was a very endearing quality for a leader, but he also learned on the trot, and he had an impact. And so, you know, there is no way to talk about him, certainly not in Venezuela, and not in the United States either, without roiling the waters on either side. It's very polarized.
And what would you add to that, Kevin? Because your piece is also very personal. You write that his knowledge of Latin American culture and history was appreciated even by his detractors across the Americas.
Yeah, I think if you went to the capitals and somewhere like Santiago or Valparaíso, I should say, in Chile, and places that where they wouldn't necessarily be his socialist allies, and that's socialist with a lowercase s, people respected the fact that he was so knowledgeable of the region. He actually, I think in the story I mentioned, being at an inauguration of the Paraguayan president, and he was suddenly surrounded by radio reporters from there, and broke into song, and not only singing a couple, you know, lines from a song, but actually singing entire songs in Guarani, which is the native language, of the Paraguayan people. It's not spoken except for a couple small parts in Bolivia, and as John's very famous novel pointed out, that Che Guevara was learning Guarani in an area where he was learning Quechua in an area that they were. Guarani, but the fact that that Chavez knew this and the words, the songs, and it endeared him, and he was obsessed with Simón Bolívar, the great liberator of South America, and this view of the Americas to the point where he added stars to the flag, made his neighbors in Colombia feel pretty uncomfortable, but was a person who wasn't an intellectual lightweight. And I think one of the things, when we keep branding him a socialist, certainly he was aligned with Castro, but in terms of, and he did nationalize parts of the industry, that is true as well. But a lot of these Latin American leaders are really more populist than socialist. And you think of someone like Evo Morales in Bolivia, who admitted, to me at least, I'm sure he's admitted to others, he's never read a single piece of work by the Marx, Lenin, anybody. So I think it's social. It's really about social justice, and I think that's how he has to be viewed.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, Trudy, I know you don't cover, obviously, Hugo Chavez, but it's interesting because he was scorned in so much media coverage for talking about the importance of taking care of the poor or possibly offering health care. But what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm no expert, certainly, in Latin American politics. I know about U.S. politics, and I do know how difficult it has been in this most recent debate on Social Security and Medicare to try to get people to understand how important these programs are to people who are on them. And it's rather astonishing to me, someone who grew up as a young reporter being sent out to cover the consumer problems of the elderly when I was 23 years old in Detroit, and learning how important Social Security was to these people. And my gosh, I hardly knew what it was. But I knew instantaneously that without it, they wouldn't survive. And it was that sort of thing that has always guided my reporting. And to sort of see the talk that I've seen over the last several months, indeed over the last 3 years that we've had this most recent debate over Social Security, see, missing ingredient in all of this is how these programs are affecting the people for whom they're intended. Mm. It's just mind-boggling that we've seen so few reporters going out in the field to try to actually interview people who are on them. And I do this series called Man on the Street. CJR holds town halls, and I often go out and talk to real people because I feel it's important to inform my reporting. Sitting here in the middle of Manhattan. And I did one over on the west side of Manhattan shortly before Christmas. I went to a senior center and talked to some very young seniors in their 60s and one in the mid-70s about how this thing called the chain CPI, which maybe many of your listeners have heard of, it is a way to change the COLA formula, cost of living formula, for beneficiaries, and it's going to affect everybody who is on the program and who will be on the program, and it's going to affect the oldest of the old the most over time. So I went out and I went through the budgets of these people and talked how they would be affected, and I realized that even a few dollars would affect them mightily. And it's that sort of thing that is not being reflected. And I guess obliquely gets back to the discussion about Latin America and distributing health care and so forth to people in those countries. But we're not talking about that here. We're talking about it on a different level, a totally elite kind of level that the media are prescribing.
And that is Trudy Lieberman, a longtime contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review, where she covers health care, Social Security, and Medicare. And we'll explore that in more depth a little later in the show, talking about Social Security and Medicare in the United States. We're also joined today by Kevin Hall. He is the national economics reporter with McClatchy. He watched Hugo Chavez in action up close for almost a decade as a foreign correspondent. He's got a piece out called "A Reporter Remembers Hugo Chavez as Steeped in Latin American Culture and History." We're also joined by John Lee Anderson. He traveled to Venezuela regularly during Chavez's presidency and interviewed him several times. His latest piece for The New Yorker is a postscript about Hugo Chavez. And we'll be talking about this for the next 5 or 10 more minutes. So we'd love to hear from you. This got so much media attention. I mean, immediate attention. And the headlines were all over the board. Various outlets are choosing to focus on different aspects of Chavez's legacy. What are your thoughts about how this has been covered? And what do you think about how it should be covered? What information are you interested in reading about when it comes to something like this, the death of President Hugo Chavez? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can leave a comment, yourcallradio.org, or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So, John, what do the facts tell us about the state of Venezuelans? Because in a couple different reports, there was a reference to the UN's Economic Commission for Latin America, and it found that from 2002 to 2010, poverty in Venezuela was reduced by about 20%. And then The Nation had a piece that said poverty was cut in half, increased availability of food and health care, expanded educational opportunities, and a real effort to build grassroots democratic institutions. What does it look like on the ground?
Well, I mean, you know, I think probably the truth is somewhere in between those two assessments. You know, it's very difficult. You have a very polarized political climate in which, you know, the mildest criticism of President Chavez would reap, you know, just very, very irate reactions from his followers. And, you know, if you were to praise Chavez, you'd be derided as a toady by the opposition. It's not an easy place to operate. And so facts and figures and statistics are perhaps going to be somewhat colored. But there's no doubt that he made poverty alleviation and the poor, who, after all, were the majority of Venezuelans and still are, the primary central plank of his government and of his revolution, as he called it. And I think he faltered on implementation. I don't think anyone could doubt Chavez's intentions and great, you know, energy in trying to carry out this task, but he was distracted by, you know, his increasing performance or, you know, goals to create a multipolar world on the international scene as in the last decade, and I think his programs at home faltered considerably. Venezuela today is a mixed bag. There's no doubt that I think that some of those statistics are correct. The average poor Venezuelan has access to subsidized food, to health care, which they never had before, and to education. They're living in miserable housing, however. It was one of his weaknesses, and he only began on it very late in the day. And that is something that is a major criticism, certainly an observation of mine. Caracas, the capital, when you arrive there from the airport, the first thing you see are slums, and they're all over. the city center is pretty much collapsed with, you know, people who've moved from the shanties on the hills into buildings, in some cases, very large buildings. I profiled a 44-story bank tower that was occupied by slum dwellers. And the government seemed incapable of kind of pulling an efficient system together that would really deal with everybody's needs and also control the society. It's also one of the most lawless urban environments in Latin America, with a very, very high homicide rate and a great degree of insecurity. So my observation would be that, you know, he made a huge attempt. He created a paradigm shift both in Latin America, in Venezuelan politics, and in Latin American politics. I think, as Lula pointed out, in Brazil, a kind of kindred soul who did it somehow more efficiently in Brazil. I think, you know, they had a better managerial class there, and they managed to alleviate poverty amongst the extreme poor without all of the militancy necessarily. Whereas in Venezuela, there was a lot of hullabaloo about things, and still is. My question is now, will this unfinished revolution be able to continue? You're talking about a country with, you know, one of the largest oil reserves in the world. It's the world's fifth or sixth largest producer of oil at the moment. It has vast wealth. It's always been a problem on how to get that wealth well distributed in the society. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that Chavez, although he made a brave effort, succeeded, and I'm concerned that in his absence, the continued polarization of the country and the mediocrity of the team that succeeds him might doom the enterprise. I have serious doubts whether they'll be able to continue. That would be my observation.
Go ahead, Kevin.
If I can jump in, I think oil will determine his legacy, what happens going forward. Remember, when he came into office, oil was at an all-time low of about $7 a barrel, $10 a barrel. He rode that up to over $100 a barrel. So, you know, he succeeded in spite of himself. And, you know, would poverty have been even more alleviated had that money been well spent? Had he not spent a lot of that money on foreign adventures in Colombia, Ecuador, Argentina, Bolivia, et cetera? Time will tell that, particularly, you know, what happens in the elections. If Capriles wins and you get the opposition in power and that money is well spent, it's going to tell us a very different historical story than if his successor wins, consolidates power, conflict continues. I think oil is a big part of the story. As John mentioned, they have huge reserves. Some believe the largest reserve in the world once you start getting unconventional oil into the mix. So there's plenty of reason to think, at least financially, the country will do well. It's how they use those resources. And it's one thing that struck me when I first started covering them, I was with a newspaper that covered international trade. And it was always striking how they were oil exporters, but they did nothing to gain any value from the oil. There was not a lot of downstream activity. There were not refineries, not much. Very little chemical manufacturing. All these things that allow you to put people to work, make money off what you're doing. And instead, it was simply the easy money rolled in, and nobody took any effort to build that out. So they have an economy that's extremely dependent on oil, and that oil money hasn't filtered into other productive ways.
Well, let's take a caller before we go to break. Let's hear from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for a very good program. What can I say about Chavez? I look at him from the perspective of a Haitian-American. Not long ago, a speech of his appeared on YouTube about Haiti, about the history of Haiti, how beautifully the man captured the essence of it, and the partnership between Haiti and Venezuela. So that remains with me. That moved me powerfully. And he was very generous towards Haiti. And also, I read this speech by Lula, which I think put it beautifully in context, Chavez's role. But last but not least, I also read the piece written in 1999, I believe, by Garcia Marquez, a man with impeccable progressive credentials, I would put it, and very critical about the two Lulas that he interviewed on a plane ride from Caracas, from Havana to Caracas. And I read that back again today. So, hey, history will have much to say about Chavez.
Yes, it will.
It may not be all positive, perhaps, but we will learn so much more about him in the future.
Well,
that will be interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I won't say any more.
Okay, thank you so much, Max. And we'll find those pieces and put links on the website. John, I know we have to let you go, but we should do a show about this because we're getting a lot of emails and calls, and we'd love to have you back. John?
Sorry, yes. Okay. No, I couldn't hear a thing that your caller said.
Oh, well, we have to go to break, but we'd love to have you back. We should do a show on this.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It'd be my pleasure.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That is John Lee Anderson, who wrote a piece about Hugo Chavez for The New Yorker. Thanks for joining us. It's your call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Sedge Thompson inviting you to join Mike Greensill and me this Saturday morning live, 10 a.m. to noon, here on KALW 91.7 San Francisco. It's our 1,000th broadcast and 1,000th week, we've been saying that right here on KALW, bringing you 2 hours of conversation, music, and play. We celebrate this week with our longtime guest, author Anne Lamott, banjo virtuoso Bela Fleck, tips on travel with Carl and Carl and perhaps another Carl, and who knows, another guest. For more information, WCL.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will have a conversation with Laurie Silverbush, co-producer of A Place at the Table. This is the new documentary that focuses on the United States' growing hunger epidemic. This is hard to believe, but over 50 million people, 1 in 4 children, do not have access to enough nutritious food to live a healthy and active life. So what explains this and what can be done about this? This film is out now, so it'd be great if you could see it over the weekend, A Place at the Table, and then be sure to join us on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we are joined by Trudy Lieberman, longtime contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review, where she covers healthcare, Social Security, and Medicare, and Kevin Hall. He is the national economics reporter for McClatchy. He spent a decade as a foreign correspondent, and he covered the late Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. And Kevin, before we move on, I just wanted to, we're just getting a lot of emails about his legacy, about the media really focusing on him being polarizing. Where do you think this goes from here? What do you expect from media coverage in the coming weeks?
Well, I think it will continue to be polarizing because he's having himself, or he's being embalmed and will be put in a mausoleum. Even in death, he will remain that divisive figure. His style was to kind of rule by chaos. He wasn't happy unless there was kind of conflict around, and it's not a criticism. It's just the way he operated, and it's every country has its own rhythm and its own history, and it's very much there. I thought Trudy made a point earlier that I wanted to swing back to that connects to your question, and it's you look in our Social Security debate and this debate over this chain CPI and which actually no metric of inflation actually gauges what seniors are actually paying. They have a whole different basket of goods, which I'm sure Trudy has written quite a bit about. But the connection is inequality, and you look at our income inequality numbers for the long, you know, and that gap. And, you know, how much that has widened in the last 30 years. Yeah. Chavez is only possible in a country where you have such inequality. And I think a Chavez-type figure, whether he's to the left or the right, in our own country is possible if we don't address these issues of inequality, because I think a populist tends to step into that vacuum.
Well, and going back to media coverage, Trudy, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting took a look at media and how they're covering Chavez, especially programs for the poor. And they point out that the Washington Post says he won, quote, unconditional support from the poverty-stricken masses by doling out jobs to supporters and showering the poor with gifts. And then NPR's All Things Considered told listeners that, quote, millions of Venezuelans loved him because he showered the poor with social programs.
Well, I think, you know, that tells you people need some sort of social support. And I think in Latin countries, they do it differently than we tend to do it in this country. But that is basically the same point, and I agree that inequality is the basis for this, and we are seeing widening inequality in America. The gains that were certainly made in America beginning in the 1950s and up through the last decade or so are beginning to change. And so we particularly see it among the elderly. And when we think about that, that's sort of a myth. I mean, we hear about the greedy geezers and they've done well. And it's due to Social Security that the elderly have done very well over the years. And certainly the Social Security cost of living increase that came in 1972 was very instrumental in keeping seniors sort of more or less whole throughout this period of heavy inflation we've had. But that's also beginning to change because we see that about half of all seniors are living on $24,000 or $22,000 or less. And some of the senior advocacy groups keep using that number, and they use it in the context of can people in that economic group afford to pay more for their Medicare benefits? And they say the answer is, of course, they cannot. And certainly a lot of the people I've interviewed over the years cannot afford to pay that. And so one of the things I think that we have to consider when we're thinking about these social programs is that what effect are they going to have on people? And I certainly think that the point being brought up that we have a measure of the cost of living formula that is not well suited to the elderly's budget and probably ought to be changed. But that change is not even being discussed. It's just, you know, and this gets back to the point that I made earlier, the discussion is very, very narrow, and it's being framed by the elite media. It's being framed by the Beltway reporters, and it is not filtering down to where the people are, and that's a problem.
Well, there was a piece, a long piece in the New York Times by Thomas Edzall. It was an opinion piece called The War on Entitlements, and he writes, "The debate over reform of Social Security and Medicare is taking place in a vacuum without adequate consideration of fundamental facts. Currently earned income in excess of $113,700 is entirely exempt from the 6.2% payroll tax that funds Social Security benefits. 5.2% of working Americans make more than $113,000 a year. Simply by eliminating the payroll tax earnings cap and thus ending this regressive exemption for the top 5.2% of earners would, according to the Congressional Budget Office, solve the financial crisis facing the Social Security system." And Kevin, he asks, why don't we talk about raising or eliminating the cap? This has strong support. 71% of Republicans and 97% of Democrats agree with this.
It has support, but it raises a question about the program. I've written about that and the point that Trudy made about the chain CPI in the Beltway media. I actually did a story about chain CPI when Boehner first proposed it and spelled out just how this is. For your listeners, the difference between how we measure inflation now and what they're proposing is that this is a less generous measure because it assumes that if prices rise, a consumer will replace it with something else. So it's a different calculation, but it doesn't get at what seniors actually pay. And the irony of our program is that seniors are the beneficiaries of Social Security, but their benefits are paid for by current workers. So the current workers' inflation is what's used to gauge the cost of living increase for the people who are already in retirement, which is kind of a backwards way of doing it. So that was one issue. And forget me, I think I've spaced on your second question.
I think that the issue that you raised, and I'd like to jump in here, that raising the amount of income subject to the payroll cap is an obvious solution. And that solution is not on the table. It's been advanced by, I hate to call them, supporters of Social Security, because that's not a term that was used when I began reporting on this decades ago. I mean, it was just Social Security. Everyone knew we needed it, and that was that. There weren't opponents and supporters, but for lack of a better term, we'll call them supporters, people who want to preserve Social Security as social insurance program, not a welfare program.
Right. And,
pardon?
And so I think that was the distinction, that if you just lift the cap altogether, then you're switching it to a welfare program where the rich are paying for the poor. I think that's
No. What they're saying is that we've lifted the cap on Medicare. There used to be a cap on Medicare earnings, and Medicare perennially has had difficulties in terms of only one of its trust funds, the hospital trust fund. Medicare as a program is not really in serious financial problem. It's only the hospital trust fund part that has financial problems, because the rest of it is sort of financed by premiums and by general tax revenues. There is a problem with the HI, the Hospital Insurance Trust Fund. And so years ago, the payroll cap was lifted on funding that. And, you know, the program continued. What happened in the last few years, and this is beginning to means test part of Medicare, and that is to change how much wealthier people pay for their benefits. And so I guess, you know, it's not totally means testing, because it's not really, the benefits are still the same. But if you change the benefits, then you change it into more of a welfare kind of program. And I think we haven't quite gotten there yet, although that is also on the table.
Yeah, I think the criticism, and I'm not saying I agree with it, I'm just completely agree with you, but I do think the criticism has been that if you lift the caps, irrespective of what we do with Medicare, Social Security has kind of a special place where it was designed so that everybody pays in and everybody gets back, and it was designed to kind of be fair to everybody, that the rich weren't going to pay excessively more than the poor, and everybody was going to benefit the same way. If you lift the cap, then you get away from that, and you get a very different kind of program, which public support may change. I'm not saying I agree with that, but I think that's the argument.
All right. I think we need to step back here. What makes the system, the income distribution that's in the system, works like this? People who have paid more into the system, people who have higher incomes, will get higher benefits in absolute dollars. People at the lower end of the income ladder will get a higher percentage of their pre-retirement income. And it's the weightings that go on in the benefit formula that decides how much people get. And it's that distribution that has been part of the system since day one that determines the kind of benefits. And that's the fairness. That's the redistribution that's going on in the system. Raising the payroll cap will just mean that people at the upper income levels will have to pay more money for their benefits. And at one point, the payroll tax did capture more of the general payroll, and that's been shrinking over the years. And advocates of that particular change think it's only fair to kind of go back to what it was.
Yeah, and I think initially, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think initially the original payroll cap was at something like 70% of income, and it's now down to a much smaller percentage for the earners.
I think it's higher than that.
And that is Kevin Hall. He is an economics reporter for McClatchy, based in Washington, D.C. Trudy Lieberman is a longtime contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review, where she covers these issues and also follows coverage of these issues. And we are talking about coverage of Social Security and Medicare. What are your thoughts on how this is being covered? It's going to get a lot more attention in the coming weeks, because White House senior economic official Gene Sperling was on CNN's State of the Union show recently, saying that President Obama is going to be putting Social Security and Medicare on the table. They're calling this entitlement reform. We often talk about how the media use the word entitlements. So what are your thoughts on how this is covered? Are there any questions you have? I mean, obviously, we're going into great detail here. When you're talking about like a four-minute radio segment or TV segment, you can't even touch these issues. So what questions do you have, and how do you think this is being covered? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org, or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Firstly, I'd like to scold the guests and commend Rose that I'm a person with a disability who's been receiving Social Security for 26 years and Medicare for 24 years. And I really do, I should be one of those people interviewed who stands to lose a lot by this privatization push. What I was going to ask as a question is, it's my understanding that Social Security is funded 6.2% from employee, 6.2% from employer, and that during the payroll tax holiday, the difference was kicked in by the general fund.
And I'm wondering, and also that Medicare is 2.9% from employer-employee split. What I'm wondering is, well, I think the answer to both problems is the horrible economy and having more people paying in. But I was under the impression, oh, and that with that Medicare Part A, where I said the 2.9%, Part B comes completely from Social Security checks. And actually, as an aside from what you were saying before, Part B is now being semi-means tested. That doesn't happen to me, but I know people who are getting deducted from how much they get in their Social Security check by their income. What I wanted to ask is, how do you see this playing into the solvency of the Medicare program and the Social Security Fund? Because I was also under the impression, I was told, that Obama is increasing some taxes to get more paid into Medicare.
Okay, can I address that?
Yes, Trudy.
Okay.
Thank you.
Your question is a very good one, and it is very, very relevant to this discussion that we're going to be having over the next several weeks. People do pay for Part B through premiums that they pay. Some Part B is also paid through general funds. So people do see a deduction from their Social Security checks each month to pay for Part B. Everybody paid the same premium for Part B up until a few years ago. That began to change. So the rule right now is that people, individuals who have incomes over $85,000 and couples with incomes over $170,000 pay an income-related premium. And what they pay is kind of on a sliding scale kind of arrangement, so it varies from family to family. So I can't tell you exactly how much people are paying. But some families are paying $300 or so a month for Part B. Other individuals, for example, might be paying $199. So there's quite a variation. There is a fair amount of talk in Washington, and particularly from the administration, to change the indexing in the law that would capture more people under that income-related premium, so that if certain changes were made, I'm not going to go into them, they're complicated, they're very into the weeds, but if certain changes are made, more people would be caught in this net of the income-related premium and have to pay more. And the Kaiser Family Foundation has crunched a lot of numbers on this, especially the president's plan that he talked about a couple of years ago. And they found that when such a plan would be fully implemented in several years, that people with incomes of around $47,000 would be paying higher income-related premiums. Now, this very much is a live issue. It very much could happen in the changes that are being discussed for Medicare. And I think a lot of people don't know about it. Mm-hmm. The advocates for Medicare beneficiaries certainly know about it. And they're the ones that have been arguing, can people with these very low incomes in the Medicare population be able to afford those increase in Part B premiums? And it's also people on disability. I think our caller indicated she was on Medicare disability. Mm. There are a lot of people on Social Security disability, and they get Medicare benefits as a result. They, too, will be affected by this. So this is something very much to watch. It is a very much a live issue.
Well, and the thing is, Kevin, we're not really hearing this angle. Because politicians are focusing on cutting Social Security and Medicare as a way to deal with the budget issue, this is the theme that you're now hearing in the media. I mean, even on, you know, the Jim Lehrer News Hour, NPR, when they have the politicians on, they will say, how do you plan to deal with entitlements? That's the main question we're hearing now.
Yeah, so, I think the distinction is, as Trudy was mentioning, those are present issues. The long-term fiscal challenges focus on the projected increases in Medicare spending And that's why you're going to see this play out in a couple of weeks in the budget battles. You're going to have a House Republican budget that has some version of the Ryan plan, Paul Ryan, Romney's running mate, who is talking about moving to kind of a voucher program for Medicare and moving away from a direct obligation. And then the Democrats are going to be proposing tax increases to make up these future projected future shortfalls. So it's playing out in the coming weeks. But I think the reason the media has covered it is because it is clear and present with the tax debate and the budget debates that we're having by March 27th to keep funding the government.
Well, okay, so then talking about the budget debate, there was a really interesting article over at Common Dreams. Business Insider polled registered voters and asked for their preferences among three congressional plans floated to avoid the sequestration cuts that took place a couple weeks ago. They found that when they stripped these plans of their partisan labels, the policies most favorable to the majority were those offered by the progressive wing of the Democratic caucus. It's called the Balancing Act. It was introduced in early February, but you're hearing none of this in the media. And what's interesting is a full 47% of Republicans preferred the House progressive plan to across-the-board cuts pushed by the Republican Party in D.C. Mm-hmm. So
I would have to see that. Maybe we can take a look at it off air, but my gut feeling is still that the way the Congress is set up is that the leadership determines kind of what moves and what doesn't, and you can have a lot of plans, but they don't really, I can't remember the last time something came up from the bottom and surfaced to the top. It's kind of leadership driven, and right now the leaders are dug in party lines.
I think it's worth pointing out, and I keep coming back to this, how are these proposals, whether it's making people pay more for Part B, whether it's raising the cap on Social Security payroll tax and making wealthier people pay more, how and who is going to be affected by them? And that question is not being asked, and it's not being addressed by the U.S. media. And Bob Blendon, who is a pollster at the Harvard School of Public Health, has said that he's done some polling, and he has said he has never seen an issue in which there was more disconnect between the elites in Washington, meaning the politicians, and what the people want when it comes to Medicare and Social Security. And the question is, who are we reporting for?
Kevin,
the answer to that is the readers, and I think we certainly try to say what it means to people. But I do think Trudy raises a good point, and the point of fairness. I think one of the questions that is going to become a big issue going forward, and you're not getting answers from either party, when do these, let's say we get to these changes, at what age do they kick in? People have been paying into Medicare, paying into Social Security with one set of promises. What age is it fair to change the rules on them? Is it 50? Is it 55? What is that cutoff age? And there's a lot of debate. Paul Ryan, Republicans are backing away from Paul Ryan's plan over this cutoff issue. He says 55. Now they're saying maybe 58, maybe 60.
Well, and Trudy, you've got 10,000 baby boomers turning 65 every single day. And 72% of them are without the protection of a benefit pension plan. And life expectancy is growing, even though people are needing health care, a lot more health care after 65.
Well, that's exactly right. We have made it possible for people to live a very long time, much longer than people lived in the 1920s and 1930s, for example, through technology, through better foods, whatever. However, if we take away those social supports and we change the cost of living formula so that someone who's 88 or 85, because God bless him, he or she will be able to live that long now, what are they going to live on? And we have to address that question. And that has not been addressed. We don't want to talk about that. We want to talk about how good our technology is that makes people live a long time, and that's a great achievement in America, but we don't want to talk about the other things that come with it.
Right, and I just want to point out that the Progressive Caucus budget would close tax loopholes and reduce the Pentagon spending by about $300 billion in waste, which, you know, you just don't hear about that. Let's take a couple calls before we have to end. Let's hear from Kevin in San Francisco. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I was just thinking about the fact that 95% of workers have 100% of their income subject to the payroll tax. And I was thinking about how Lloyd Blankfein, the current CEO of Goldman Sachs, a Wall Street titan, talked about how entitlements need to be adjusted, meaning they need to be made more stringent. Well, this guy made, last year he made $21 million, and only, well, what, $100,000 of that is subject to the payroll tax? You think about most, the typical Wall Street banker makes $1 million, so 10% of their income is subject to the payroll tax. Even Rush Limbaugh is another example who made his annual salary is $28 million a year, so he meets that payroll tax obligation after the first day and a half of work, January 2nd. Where is the groundswell, the anger, where so many people are subject, 100% of their income is subject to the tax, and 5% are not? Why? If they simply remove the cap, and I've talked to Nancy of Congressman Pelosi's office about this, I've made phone calls, asking them why it's never being discussed. If that simply was removed, there would be no issue with that program whatsoever. But you've got these people that make enormous salaries who are the ones that are talking the loudest about cutting the entitlements.
Yeah, Trudy, he makes a great point. Pelosi was on the NewsHour last night. She talked about closing tax loopholes, but I didn't hear her mention anything about the Social Security cap.
Well, I didn't hear her last night, but you don't hear very many politicians talking about this. I think sometimes there might be a stray progressive or so talking about it. But it, as I said, it is not on the table. And a lot of people say, as your caller has, that if that happens, the program will be solvent as far as the eye could see. And Lloyd Blankfein was on CBS News because I wrote about his appearance on the CBS Evening News show sometime in December when he was talking about that we had to do something about entitlements and people had to get used to living on less. So there you have it.
Kevin, we've got just about a minute left. Go ahead.
Yes, Social Security isn't being talked about because it's not really on the table in the budget. It's off budget, and it's eminently solvable. And I think everybody, it's heavily politicized, but everybody knows you can raise the age, you can lift the caps. There's very easy solutions. Medicare is a tougher one because, as you noted, all the 75 million baby boomers starting well into the first wave of this now hitting, and it is going to change our political landscape and our economic landscape. But there are solutions. The Bush tax cuts, had they simply been restored, the imbalance goes away.
And Kevin, you don't think that Social Security is on the table despite what the economic official Gene Sperling said last week?
No, I think it will be dealt on us. I don't think it will be part of a grand bargain. And I think it's one that I think people think is fixable, and politicians on both sides fear seniors. I don't think they're going to seriously change it.
All right. Well, we will definitely follow that. And yeah, thanks for bringing up the Bush tax cuts. That should always be part of this conversation. The Bush-Obama extension tax cuts, we should say. Kevin Hall is a national economics reporter based in Washington, D.C. for McClatchy. And Trudy Lieberman closely covers these issues for the Columbia Journalism Review. Find their work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you so much for your emails and phone calls. Thanks for listening. Happy International Women's Day. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up on Monday. What are the economic, social, and cultural implications of hunger? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Laurie Silverbush, co-producer of A Place at the Table. It's a new documentary that focuses on the United States' growing hunger epidemic. Over 50 million Americans, one in four children, do not have access to enough nutritious food to live a healthy and active life. So what explains this hunger epidemic, and what will it take to eradicate it? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.